In July 1949, Penguin Books published 1 million copies of 10 books by Miss Niall Marsh, the New Zealand writer of detective fiction. Miss Marsh was the second writer to be published in this way. Following her first success as a detective writer, her books have been read in German, French, Italian, Spanish, Dutch, Norwegian, and Swedish, as well as English. New Zealand already knew Niall Marsh as a producer in the theatre, and her productions were later seen in Australia and in London.
That is a milestone in the career of any writer, and Niall Marsh is primarily a writer. But how does she write a thriller?
People often ask one whether it's more fun to produce a play or to write a detective novel. It's a question that it's quite impossible to ask. There are two forms of pleasure and there are two forms of pain, and they can be, both of them, extremely irksome and very trying indeed. As for the writing of detective fiction, I think I probably set about it in a rather unusual way, or in things that my fellow practitioners have said to me about the way they set about starting their books. I rather draw the conclusion that my own approach is a rather odd one. Most writers of detective novels start with the plot. They start with the idea for a murder or an idea for a particular bit of a mechanism of crime, as it were. I don't, or I hardly ever do. I usually start with a group of people. For one reason or another, a person pops into one's mind, and then somebody else, and then somebody else. They run together like bits of mercury, and you find you've got a group of people. You know pretty well what they're like to look at, pretty well how they tick over. And because you're a writer of detective fiction, you have to involve these people in a crime of violence. And that is your problem. The other way is to think up a mechanism, to think up a way of killing somebody or committing some crime, and then invent the people that will fit into that particular kind of crime. I think I probably write in the other way, the way of beginning with people first, because I'm one of the group of detective fiction writers who try to write, as it were, in the third dimension. I think myself that we will never entirely succeed in what we do, because we can't be altogether candid about at least one person in the book we're writing, the committer of the crime. Such are the exigencies of detective fiction. You've got to keep what's going on inside one of your characters a dead secret until the end. But if you are going to write three-dimensionally, or try to write three-dimensionally, then I think you've got to start with people and not with plot. I get my group of people, then, if I'm lucky, I think up some method of crime, I involve them in it, and presently, if the book's going at all well, they begin to take on a sort of activity of their own, and I begin to learn how they will behave under the given circumstances. I'm not going to try and defend detective fiction or abuse it, but there is this to be said, I think, in its favour, that it's one of the few forms left in prose writing today which is a real form, which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Detective fiction has to be written with the very greatest economy. It has to be written with balance and with form. And there is this to be said of it, I think, that within its limitations, and its limitations are very severe, but within them, one may write as well as one is able. There's nothing against writing with as good a style as one can command. But I'm not here to write to speak an apology about detective fiction. I write the books in longhand, sitting on the floor very late at night, as a rule. And hitherto, my secretary, or a typist, has translated them into typescript. Very much later, the typescripts hagged over again, gone over, correlated, cut, built up, generally tortured, until finally it's ready to go into its final typing, and then face the printer. During that process, that long process of 9 months' hard work, and it is hard work, I always think one's very much in the position of a barrister. One's getting up a case. One has to look up all sorts of things about which one knows nothing. You mug it all up. You have it at your fingertips, you write about it, and as soon as the book's finished, you forget all about it. I've got a technical library, really. I've amassed through the years at home works on medical jurisprudence, on criminology, on poisons, crimes of violence, any number of them. And it is true that however simple the crime one may start off with, in less than no time one finds oneself involved in technicalities. For instance, I suppose the simplest kind of murder would be A hits B in a dark alley over the head with a brick and runs away. Well, you'd think that would be quite simple, but if you were writing about that, it wouldn't be nearly as simple as it sounds. B is found in the dark alley with his skull stove in and a brick lying beside him. Before you know where you are, you'd have to be looking up the component parts of brick dust, the workings of kilns where bricks are made, the whole pathology of cranial injuries, blood groups, everything, and even the simplest crime suddenly involves one in technicalities, and that's part of our job. And it isn't a dull thing to do, looking up these things, but it's a very exacting thing. The readers of detective fiction are almost exclusively professional people, and the great majority of them are men. They're lawyers and parsons and soldiers and sailors and doctors and, of all things, policemen. And I can only suppose that policemen read detective novels because they're quite unlike anything they ever experienced in their daily life. But read them they do. And you see, those are the very boys who can find you out if you make a blunder. And believe me, if you make a blunder, you hear from them. For my own part, I must say, and I suppose this sounds rather odd, I don't read detective novels. I don't read them, partly because it's too much like a busman's holiday, and partly because if I did, I think I would always be in an agony of wondering whether they were going to write about my next idea but one, or about my last idea but two. At any rate, it remains that I do not read detective fiction. I read something very different for my entertainment. Well, I read Elizabethan literature, I think, more than anything else. I read the plays of that time and of the early Jacobean time, and I read a very great deal of Shakespearean commentary, because my great love is the production of Shakespeare's plays, and somehow or another I just never get tired of reading them. They happen over and over again. They live by my bedside, and they're my bedside reading. Indeed, when I go to bed, it's about the only time I ever get to read. But there it is, Elizabethan literature, with the emphasis very heavily on the plays of Shakespeare and on some of the things that have been written about them. That, I think, more than anything else. Certain amount of biography, and I'm trying to catch up on my modern novelists, but I'm a jolly long way behind with them. My fellow practitioners, as I think I said a little while ago, do all read very learnedly about detective fiction, and they write very learnedly about it too. In particular, I think Dorothy Sayers, who is famous for many other things, but she's also famous among her fellow practitioners for having laid down a set of rules for the writing of detective fiction. She did this at about the time the Detection Club was founded in London. The Detection Club is a very small club, it's a very select club. It consists, I think, only of about 20 members, as far as I can remember, and they are all practicing writers of detective fiction. They have their club rooms in London, and to belong to the club, one must absolutely undertake to attend, well, I think it's 4 or 6 meetings a year. For that reason, although they very kindly asked me to become a member, I'm unable to be one. But whenever I go to England, they always ask me to one of their do's. And I remember the astonishment with which I encountered the first do that I was ever asked to by the Detection Club in London. Dorothy Sayers asked me to it. It was a dinner. It was held at the Dorchester, very grand indeed. And it consisted of the usual dinner with a very good address from the Chief Constable of Surrey. But after dinner, the Detection Club was going to inaugurate its new president, who was E.C. Bentley. You all know as the author of Trent's Last Case. A very elderly man, indeed. They were all rather elderly, were the members of the Detection Club. However, my agent and I, who were the only two non-members, were sat by a wall in a private drawing room at the Dorchester, and the members of the club all left the room. The lights were lowered, and a sort of pulpit was put down in the room, very close to me. We waited in dead silence. The door was flung open, and in came, really, I think, the oddest procession I've ever seen in my life. It consisted of my peers in the field of detective fiction, and very much, I may say, my seniors. In they came. Miss Sayers was leading them, a formidable figure, wearing her academic robes. She was followed by Freeman Wills Croft and John Rode and Anthony Gilbert and so on, all the names you all know, I'm sure, very well. Each one was the warden of something. And John Rode, I remember, was the warden of the skull, and he carried a skull on a cushion and lit it up from within by a cunning device. And poor old E.C. Bentley, looking very nervous and very self-conscious, was led forward. Miss Sayers mounted the pulpit, and she read a terribly classy sort of preamble to him. It was written by somebody frightfully grand, like D.H. Lawrence or Aldous Huxley or something. I don't remember quite who, but somebody of that sort. It was all about never conceiving clues and all the things that we know we mustn't do when we're writing these books. And it was administered in the form of an oath, and poor Mr. Bentley, in a trembling voice, took the oath. And halfway through, I thought, dismay, that in the folds of that academic robe, Miss Sayers was conceiving a six-shooter. And blow me down flat, if at the end of the administration of this oath, she somehow produced the six-shooter and let it off there in the private drawing room of Dorchester House. The noise was deafening. I screamed at the top of my voice, and my agent laughed like a hyena, and it took us some time to get back to the right level of popularity. But however, after all that was over, we withdrew to their rooms in Soho, where there are pictures of gentlemen hanging by the neck on the walls, and everybody grumbles about their publishers, and a jolly evening's had by all. That's the Detection Club, and it's great fun while you're there.
Niall Marsh is a successful writer of detective fiction. But how did she start? What gave her the idea? She was in England in the early years of the Depression, and had been dabbling in many things, a house decorating business for one. But even then, she had other interests and talents.
It was at that time that, in addition to the shop, I began writing travel articles for the Associated Press in New Zealand. And it was at about that time, too, I think, working very hard in the shop all the time, which was prospering, that I read my first detective novel. I can't remember now who it was by. I rather think it was an Agatha Christie, but if so, I've forgotten which. At any rate, I had a wet weekend alone in the flat in London, and I read this thing, and I believe I could do something of this sort. Well, at that time, the murder game was very fashionable in England. If you went away for a weekend, you were sure to play the murder game, the game in which somebody has chosen, you know, to be a murderer, and you tack them on the shoulder and say you're dead, and then the rest of the game is finding out who'd done it. And I thought, what a good idea if instead of finding a bogus corpse in the murder game, you found a real corpse. Good start, thought I, for a detective novel. Shall I try? So in the evenings in penny exercise books, I wrote the book which now sends me scarlet in the face whenever I see it. Unfortunately, it's still in print. It's awfully bad. It was called A Man Lay Dead, which sounds rather like a man laid egg, I think. And I'd no sooner finished writing it than I suddenly got news from a friend that a Frenchman, I suppose it was Georges Simenon, I don't know, but a Frenchman had written a book on exactly the same subject and got ahead of me, and it was out. And so I thought, well, that's the beginning and end of my career as a writer of detective fiction. However, at that time I had to come out to New Zealand very suddenly, so I dumped this affair with an agent in London, came out here, and was astounded to learn about 4 months later, I think it was, that had been accepted for publication. And, of course, if once you write a detective novel, let me warn all listeners, if you write your first detective novel and get it published, you're absolutely sunk. You'll go on writing them until you're on crutches. You're sunk. You're a detective fiction monger. If you want to write anything else, you'll have to write it under another name. However, I saw a sort of future in that. I was obliged then to live in New Zealand for some time. I was looking after my father, and so I wrote several more detective novels, and at the same time found what I think has turned out to be quite a successful formula for life, that it is possible To write a detective novel, it takes just about as long as it does to have a baby, about 9 months. To write a detective novel, and then when you've had passed the throes of parturition with a detective novel, you can turn around and produce a play. It's a sort of ambivalent life, but I've quite enjoyed it.
Niall Marsh is almost better known in New Zealand for her theatrical productions, especially her work in the last few years with the Canterbury University College students.
It was in 1944, I think, at the beginning of 1944, that two young men from Canterbury University College came to call on me one rather hot afternoon. I remember them coming up the hill, and I remember them saying to me in rather loud voices, would I produce a play for them at Canterbury College? I had produced a play in a very small way before, but this time I took thought for a minute or two, and I said, yes, I will, if you make the play Hamlet. I can see their two faces now looking very astonished, because I don't think a Shakespearean play was in either of their minds when they came up the hill. But the nice thing about working with students is that they don't pause very much for thought. They know what they want, and they go in a straight line for it. And after we'd all three stared at each other for a little while, they said, why not? And it was in that way that the first of those plays was born, as it were, the first of those projects was born. I held a gun to their head and said it had got to be Hamlet. They called my bluff and said, very well, it would be. And a few days later, I went down into that little theatre that was not so very long ago, burnt in Canterbury College, and saw the crowd of those young people of whom I was to become so fond and so with whom I was to become so very closely associated for the next 4 or 5 years. There they all were, sitting in rows in the little theatre, and we began our auditions. And together with these youngsters, of course nearly all of them boys, we embarked on that extraordinary adventure which is Hamlet. I dare say a good many of my listeners will remember that first season of Hamlet in the little theatre. We literally had the audience hanging from the rafters. It was the first time, I think, for 20 years that a Shakespeare play had been done in Christchurch, if not in New Zealand. And we had young audiences who had never experienced a Shakespeare play in any form but the terrible one in which it's dished out to them at their schools. And the little theatre really did seem to crackle. Of course, the production was as full of faults as it possibly could be. It was very, very young. It was very inexperienced. But it had an immense vitality. And it was quite a phenomenal success. We even had complaints from the police about the length of the queues. We had to keep reviving it and re-reviving it. Well, Hamlet was followed by Othello, and then a very well-known regisseur, Mr. Dan O'Connor, said that he would like to take Hamlet and Othello on tour through New Zealand in the long vacation. And that tour came about and was highly successful. Before I went to England for the last time, Mr. O'Connor extended his previous plans and he took us with Othello and with Pirandello's Six Characters in Search of an Author on an Australian tour in the long vacation. And that tour, too, was immensely successful. And those tours, successful as they've been and rough though the productions were, have proved one thing to me, and one thing that I've been very glad to learn, that the plays of Shakespeare, if they're done with heart, if they're done straightforwardly, if they're done with an immense expenditure of energy and with a real respect for the text, have something that no other dramatic writing has for any audience. And undoubtedly, there is an audience for the plays so done in this country. Quite undoubtedly, there is. My experience with those students has been a most valuable one to me. I'm immensely grateful to them. Our relationship has been a remarkable one. The relationship between the producer and his players is always something rather extraordinary. Something is generated during the rehearsal period. each side is giving out a tremendous amount of energy, I suppose, to the other. One forms an immense affection for one's cast, and if one's fortunate enough, they, I think, return it. Something happens, and something happened that is immensely valuable, I think, to all of us. One's often asked, of course, about the future of the Flesh and Blood Theatre in New Zealand. It's inevitable. Everybody asks us about that. I wouldn't have felt that I could give any opinion about it at all, really, I think, if I hadn't had the experience 3 years ago of bringing a professional company through New Zealand, the British Commonwealth Theatre Company. It was formed in London. The actors were representative of the various dominions, and we came out to New Zealand for a year's tour, really as a sort of tryout. It was a confusing, a baffling, an exciting, an exhilarating, and at the same time a disappointing experience. The plays were very successful, but it was proved on that tour that such is the state of affairs in New Zealand now that unless a company of that sort and of that size can fill a theatre absolutely to capacity every night, it's going to be almost impossible for it to meet the vastly disproportionate cost of moving it from one place to another. We have a national orchestra. We have all sorts of things in the way of arts that are supported by the state. Bursaries, scholarships, this, that, and the other thing. The Flesh and Blood Theatre, if it is to establish itself here with a feeling of permanence, without the nerve-wracking, heartbreaking, back-breaking, agonizing anxiety that must attend any company at all that is not state-supported, if we are to have a theatre of that sort, fairly happily placed in the country, not working under a sort of stranglehold, then we must have, in my opinion, a national grant, and we should have it now. We are, I think, in New Zealand, particularly theatre-minded. When I say we're theatre-minded, I'm not referring to the repertory society audiences, which are, I think, very, very much propelled by a sort of social thing, rather than by, altogether, a devout love for the theatre. Behind those established repertory society audiences, there are the young people of New Zealand, the really important people. And I have proved, over and over again, entirely to my own satisfaction, that they are quite remarkably good as a potential audience for classical plays in a good Flesh and Blood theatre.
Theatre and detective fiction are the two things for which Niall Marsh is best known. But as a young girl, she started out with thoughts of quite a different career.
When I left school, I became an art student. The longueur of the antique room and the endless procession of still lifes that seemed somehow or another to be the dubious flowering of some degraded cellar did nothing to cool our ardour. We all battled away in the airless fervour of the life room, or beside the lakes of Westland, or before the foothills of South Canterbury. But, of course, I realise now that as an art student, I suppose I really was just among the number that were merely working off in the regulation manner, something that adolescents do try to work off. They try to express themselves in some form or another, and I was trying to express myself with paint and with charcoal and with pencils, and I got a certain way with it. But I woke up one fine morning and realised that I'd never be the painter that I thought I was setting out to be. And oddly enough, that coincided with something that has made an enormous difference. All through the art student days, I was still frantic about theatre. I used to go to the gallery, to anything that came round, including the Alan Wilkie Shakespearean Company. And I also found time to write, and I'm sure I don't know how I did it now I look back, an appalling melodrama called The Medallion, which I had the cheek to send to Mr. Alan Wilkie. And he very kindly gave me an opinion of it. I think over the opinion we'll draw a veil. But the extraordinary thing was that he asked me if I'd like to join his company and become an actress. Of course, he said, I'm sure you're going to do something in the theatre. I can remember him saying it very well. You're going to do something in the theatre, and you'd better know a little bit more about it. And so I did, at the drop of a hat, left off being an art student and became an actress. And off I went. The only stipulation my parents made was that I wasn't to leave New Zealand. So when the company left New Zealand, I cunningly joined another company. And I kept on at that for 2 years, learning an enormous amount about how the wheels go around in a company. That I did for about 2 years, and then I came back to Christchurch, thinking myself a veteran, and for an organization known as Unlimited Charities, I produced two or three really very big ventures for a girl of that age, two or three musical shows in the Old Theatre Royal. And in addition to that, with my great friends, the Tahu Rhodeses, we formed a little touring company that went round and did things for charity called Touch and Go. They went to England, leaving me behind in New Zealand, and a year later, in 1928 it was, I followed them and went home and stayed with them in England. And that was just before the slump, and I got the tag end of those very raffish but very wonderful 20s in London. But however, along came the slump, and at about the same time as the slump, along came an enormous charity bazaar for which we were asked to do something. And in the deserted ballroom of the house that my great friends had then, Nellie Rhodes and I worked away making all sorts of things for this blasted charity bazaar. When we'd made the whole lot of them, we suddenly said, why aren't we doing this for ourselves? Because already they were beginning to feel a pinch of the slump and had five children to educate. So spurred on by that thought, we went into London, and there and then we took a little lock-up shop in the Brompton Road, and made a whole lot of things for Christmas and set ourselves up in this little shop for Christmas and did jolly well, too. We had a success. That was fatal, of course, having planned only to do it for Christmas and having had a success, we immediately took another shop on a rather longer lease and overnight we found ourselves house decorators. We were terribly like null-cowed shop girls. We knew nothing whatever about it. We made the most fabulous mistakes. But for some extraordinary reason, we survived the slump, nearly educated a couple of kids, and I kept myself.
Niall Marsh has gone back and forth between New Zealand and England many times since then. And she says now,
I'm going back to England to freshen myself up, to find out what's happening in the theatre there, to publish another book. We live a very long way away from things in New Zealand. A great many of us go away and don't come back. But I should come back to New Zealand because I must. One feels one must.
We've called this program A Portrait of Niall Marsh, but it's really a portrait of Niall Marsh at work because, you see, she doesn't talk about herself. She talks about what she does, not what she is. And that in itself gives you a portrait of Niall Marsh.
My aunt's house on Cashmere Hills was a large, old-fashioned one in the ugly but spacious colonial Edwardian style. It was here, in the bay window of the dining room, that at the age of 10 I produced my first play. My cousins, younger than myself and willing, but not particularly enthusiastic, were pressed into the service, and my father, I think it must have been my father, built a stage by the simple means of laying a platform across the window seats. Victor Hugo's four boards, in fact, were there, and his passion, as I hope to show, was not lacking. And the piece was Cinderella, dramatized by myself, in rhymed couplets, of which I've forgotten, I think, all but Cinderella's first soliloquy. And for this soliloquy, my little cousin was discovered in rags, sitting pensively by the classic ashes, and she mused. Oh, dear, oh, dear, what shall I do? Of balls I've been to such a few. Just once I've seen that handsome prince, and I've never seen him since. And upon this note of almost Kafka-like frustration, I, in the role of the fairy godmother, beat heavily at the door and made my entry. I remember that there was an audience and that we were all extremely pleased with ourselves. I think the thing that sticks in my mind most is this, that it was so typical of my parents to give this production their serious and not uncritical attention. And it is remarkable that they should have found time to do so at all, since they were always up to their eyes themselves in amateur theatricals. My mother's point of view about acting was, in everything but the mere fact, entirely professional. The conventions of her time, and a certain natural fastidiousness, really prevented her from accepting the quite astonishing opportunities that presented themselves to her in the theatre of her youth. But she refused them all, and she married, and for the rest of her life, she burst the seams of any amateur performance that she appeared in quite punctually. She was my severest critic. She was silent about my attempts at acting, how wisely, for indeed from the beginning they were quite lamentable. But she was always prepared to give her brief but concentrated attention to anything I tried to write or to draw, and especially to anything I tried to make other people do on any kind of stage. And so, encouraged by all this, throughout my school days, I perpetually meddled with theatricals. I produced the little girls of the lower school for breaks up and prize givings in horrid little fairy plays that I wrote myself, and I regrettably appeared as the villain in plays written by our French master in his native tongue. In Monsieur Malicant's plays, one had to strike attitudes and say things like vipère, while one poured poison into the wine subsequently drunk by the dauphin in captivity. We also, St. Margaret's, at our annual prize givings, appeared in dramatizations of Tennyson and translations of the Greek tragedies. And I can't help thinking now that these productions must have given a great deal of discomfort to my dear but discerning parents.